Pseudopod, episode 109, September 26th, 2008. This week's story, In the Coils of the Serpent, by William Meikle. Hello, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from William Meikle. William has had four short films adapted from his work, has another four on the way, and has two stories in upcoming Wrong World DVD anthologies. Your narrator this week is podcast renaissance man KJ Johnson. So, grab a set of gloves, a clean suit, and a stiff drink. Especially that last one, because I have a story for you. And I promise you, it's true.
In the Coils of the Serpent, by William Meikle.
So after he killed her, he cut out the clitoris. Well, that settles it. It can't have been a man. If it had been, he'd never have found it. I looked up at her over the top of my drink, but there was no humor in her eyes. Then again, there rarely was these days. I don't know why I'm telling you all this anyway, I said, taking a long swig of beer and brushing the foam from my upper lip. If the boss ever finds out, I'll be knocked back to traffic patrol. This is all supposed to be hush-hush. Even the tabloids haven't got hold of it yet. I should hope not, Jane Woolsey replied. If they get so much as a whiff that I'm involved, you won't see me for dust. I didn't blame her. I remembered the last time, the finding of the body, the lurid headlines, the media circus permanently encamped on her doorstep. I would do everything in my power to make sure that didn't happen again. She was playing with her hair, twirling the blonde tresses around her little finger. She had that faraway look in her eyes again, as if she was staring fixedly at something in the far distance that only she could see. I leaned over and took her hand. I'll try to keep the press out of it, Jane. I really will. There was a deep resignation in her voice as she replied, I know you will, but will you succeed? She sighed and took a long sip from her drink. I take it you brought something for me? She asked. You didn't bring me out here just to hold my hand? I realized that I was not only holding her hand, I was stroking my index finger along the soft skin between her thumb and forefinger. Suddenly embarrassed, I let her hand drop. Don't worry, she said, and this time there was a sparkle of humor in her eyes. I won't tell anybody. To cover my discomfort, I reached into my inside pocket, but not before checking that no one in the quiet bar was looking our way. The boss doesn't know I've got this. He'll have my guts for garters if he finds out, I said, handing a handkerchief over the table. I watched her pupils dilate as she took the flimsy piece of cloth. Almost immediately, her eyes rolled up in their sockets, until only white showed beneath her fluttering eyelids. She moaned, a deep bass drone, then gasped, just once. I wanted to reach over, to take her hand, but I knew better than to interrupt. This was a crucial moment. Suddenly she screamed, her mouth gaping to show twin rows of perfect teeth, her nostrils flaring. Her head fell forwards, a swath of hair obscuring her face, her shoulders trembling violently. She flung the piece of cloth away and screamed again, louder this time. The handkerchief floated slowly off the edge of the table, but Jane's body beat it on the way down, her head hitting the hard wooden floor with a loud thud that echoed in the silence of the small bar. By the time I got round the table, she was shaking, in the throes of some kind of fit. I lifted her by the shoulders and hugged her to my chest, brushing away the barmaid who was hovering beside, half-heartedly offering help. No, just leave her. She'll be all right in a minute, I said, stroking Jane's hair and rocking her softly from side to side. She opened her eyes and looked up. I was shocked to see tears in her eyes. Get me out of here, Dave. Take me home, please. I lifted her to her feet, and she stood, unsteady at first, staring out the customers in the bar until they had all turned back to their drinks. She walked to the door unaided, but as soon as it had shut behind us, she leaned on my arm. You're going to have to be careful. This one's a bad one. And that was all she would say. She sat, quiet and pale, beside me, unanswering as I tried to find out what she had seen, where she had been. Even as I left her at her door, she refused to speak. Not now. Not in the dark. Come round tomorrow. She turned away and then seemed to think better of it, looking back at me. I meant what I said, though. Be very careful. I had a chill all up my spine as I turned back to the car, a chill that was to stay with me all the way back to the station. As I drove, I let my mind slip back to the previous case we had both been involved in. I'd been sitting in my office, looking for a lead on the missing girl, sifting reports and interviews, trying to find anything that would give me a handle on the case. Someone had knocked on my door, but I hadn't really registered it, and I only looked up when I heard my visitor's chair on the cheap linoleum. "I'm sorry to bother you, officer, but I know where the girl is." That was all she said, but even back then, before I had seen what she was capable of, I had believed in her implicitly. I had also fallen in love with her. After we found the girl, I took her out several times, each time getting closer to breaking through her tight defenses, but that had all stopped when the press found out. They got onto her case straight away. "Witch woman finds tragic toddler." That had been the kindest of the headlines. It wasn't long before a smear campaign had implicated her in the toddler's death, even though she had a cast-iron alibi. Not long after, she had gone into hiding. I hadn't seen her in 3 years, until tonight. The call had come out of the blue. It was almost a replay of the last time, still sifting reports, still poring over countless interviews. This time it was the phone which interrupted me. Part of me knew who it would be, even before I lifted the handset. "I know something about the one you are looking for," she said. "Bring me something belonging to one of the victims. I'll be in the Green Man after 7. She had rung off abruptly, and her tone had been sharp and distant, but my heartbeat had been up as I headed for the pub. My stomach was doing giddy flip-flops in anticipation. Even now, on my way back from the meeting, I still felt that old adolescent tingling, but then I remembered her eyes as she had given me the warning, and the shiver came back. I had to grip the steering wheel tightly to stop my hands shaking. The chill was still there as I entered the station, but was soon dispersed by Sergeant Briggs and a cup of steaming coffee. Briggs was an office regular. His wife had long since gone, unable to cope with the unusual hours the police kept. It didn't seem to bother Briggs. He always spent all his spare time here anyway, and if anything, he seemed happier now than before. Besides, he made great coffee.
"Couldn't sleep again, sir?" the sergeant asked, a wide grin on his face. He knew full well that I shared his problem. I just couldn't keep away from the job.
"Aye, something like that, sergeant." The coffee burned away at the roof of my mouth. I sighed loudly as its warmth began to spread through my stomach.
"Nearly as good as whiskey," I said appreciatively, holding my cup up in a mock salute. "Anything going on?"
Briggs snorted as if in disgust.
"The chief is out at another one of his dinners. PC Douglas is plugged into his computer again, the night shift had been called out to a disturbance in the town center, and I'm trying to make sense of the pathologist report. Apart from that, everybody else is packed up for the night."
He stopped and looked so serious that I almost laughed.
"If you don't mind me saying so, sir, it might be better if you did the same yourself. You look like shit."
This did make me laugh, but my heart wasn't in it.
I know, but I've got a bad feeling about this guy. I don't think he's going to stop."
It was only then that the sergeant's remark about the pathologist's report struck me.
"So, what's this about old Swan's report? Don't tell me he cocked it up again." "No, he's done a good job. I just don't understand the conclusions. Come through and I'll show you."
Apart from a single angle-poise lamp center on his desk, Briggs' room was cloaked in darkness. The desk itself was strewn with open reports and papers. He had obviously been busy for quite some time.
"Just let me run through it with you, sir. See if you can make anything of it," he said. "Mary Wells, 23, single, no current boyfriend. One ex-lover with a cast-iron alibi. Secretary at a reputable firm of estate agents. She's sitting at home watching television when, round about midnight, someone knocks at her door. We've surmised this from the fact that there are no recorded calls to her house that evening, and from physical evidence found on the doorstep, but I'll get on to that later. The villain comes in. Is he known to her? We don't know, but there are no signs of struggle in the hallway or on the stairs. It's only when we get to the bedroom that we find any evidence of the intruder at all, and even that doesn't get us very far. They may have had sex, but there's no bruising, no scratches, no tissue under the victim's nails, and he kills her, method as yet unknown. He draws a picture on her abdomen, a spiral pattern that might or might not be significant, and takes her eyes, nipples, and parts of her genitalia before he's finished, all without leaving any trace of how he did it, or so we thought last night, anyway.
Briggs sat back in his chair and sighed, looking more tired than I had ever seen him.
"I've had PC Douglas check up on the spiral pattern. He reckons it's a representation of Hrafnir, a Celtic water serpent with supernatural power, if you can believe any of that. Apparently, it was famous for carrying off and mutilating young women."
He gave me another long sigh and closed the folders in front of him.
I'm getting too old for this shit, he said. Begging your pardon, sir.
That's all right, I replied. Some days I know just how you feel. But what's got you so worked up? You haven't told me anything we didn't know yesterday.
The sergeant picked up a report and slid it across the table.
Three things, he began. One, the lab report on some earth found on the victim's doorstep, only it's not earth. From the concentration of rotted vegetation, they reckon it could only have come from the bottom of a deep-sea loch, and recently, too.
So we're looking for a fisherman or a scuba diver, then? I asked, hopefully.
Maybe, Briggs replied. I hope so, I really do.
He rocked back in his chair and stared at the ceiling. This time I recognized the look on his face. It wasn't tiredness this time, it was fear. The sergeant's voice barely rose above a whisper as he continued.
The victim's lungs were full of water, which had been mixed with brown organic matter. She drowned. And guess what the analysis of the water told us?
Don't tell me. A deep-sea loch?
Right first time. And they didn't have sex, but her vagina also carried traces of the same water, as did her bathtub.
I sipped the dregs of the coffee as I tried to take in this latest information.
So where did the water come from? Do you know how far we are from the nearest sea lock? It must be nearly 100 miles. Did the villain lug the water all the way? And just how much do you need to kill somebody?
Now you see what I've been sitting here thinking about. I had the house's system checked out. Nothing there but standard tap water.
You said there were three things, I asked, hoping that more information might shed light on the problem. I was disappointed.
Aye, three things. The earth on the doorstep, the lock water in the lungs, and best of all, no prints, no fibers, no physical evidence apart from the water. It's as if he was never there.
I nearly choked on my last mouthful of coffee.
What? Nothing at all?
Briggs looked serious.
Not even a single hair. I've never seen anything like it. The lab boys are mystified. I've sent them back to get more samples, just in case it's all a huge cock-up. They're over there now.
They wanted to wait till morning, but begging your pardon, sir, I told them that you'd have their balls in a basket if they tried to file that report. And one last thing. The boys from the press have got a whiff of the story. They're already encamped outside the house.
I stood and stretched my spine, palms pressed hard against the flat of my back. I was acutely aware of the layers of fat which I had to press against, and I groaned as my bones resisted any movement.
I think I'll go over there and take a look around. Maybe I'll see something I missed the last time. You never know. We gotta get lucky sometime on this one.
In the meantime, get the ex-boyfriend in for a chat. We should have spent more time on him yesterday.
Maybe you're not the only one who's getting too old for this shit.
I gave Briggs a mock salute, John Wayne style, and headed out into the night. This used to be my favorite time of the night, right around midnight, the pubs all empty and no one on the streets but me. I had spent many a long hour just savoring the quiet while tramping the beat, marveling at moonlight on the trees, surprising the occasional fox, and very rarely catching a burglar about his business. But that was back then, back in the 60s when I'd been no more than a teenager myself, back before mass unemployment, longer opening hours, and free access to drugs had changed this town forever. Now I was more likely to be surprised myself, mugged for the few pence I carried in my pocket. Tonight, even though the streets were quiet, I felt I could sense the evil lurking. And to make matters worse, there was a killer loose, a silent killer who left no clues, no witnesses. I prayed to God that this was a one-off, a family tiff of some kind. The last thing this town needed was a serial killer on the rampage. When I got to the street where the murder had been committed, I almost turned back. It had been too long a night. I was tired, and looking at a crime scene always depressed me anyway. Only the thought that the perpetrator was still at large kept me going. In contrast with the rest of the street, number 23 had every light in the house blazing, a beacon in the darkness. Although it was a cold night, the front door was wide open. A succession of white-coated men carried small plastic bags to a van in the driveway. A huddle of reporters stood in the garden nursing cups of coffee. I hoped that no one had been stupid enough to talk to them yet. I knew that I would have to call a press conference sooner rather than later, but not just yet. As I approached the house, the reporters noticed me. They came forward with their usual bluster, flash units carried before them like revolvers. It was only when I got to the front door that I managed to shrug them off.
Just stay there, I said. I'll tell all of you what we know when I come out.
I hoped that would keep them quiet for a while, but I knew my picture was going to be splashed across the papers in the morning. I just wish I'd combed my hair. The crime scene was like any other. Whatever it was that had made this house a home had long since gone, leaving only a clinical silence through which white-coated policemen moved slowly and reverentially. I looked down at the dead girl's bed for long seconds, but nothing came to me. My mind was blank and my body was tired. All I wanted to do was to lie down on those two soft pillows and let blackness take me away. It wasn't to be. I was jolted out of my reverie by someone calling my name. It was only on the second occasion that I recognized the voice, and by then the reporters were on her like a pack of jackals. I ran down the stairs, almost knocking over a rookie who was too scared, too embarrassed to berate me. I flung open the door and found myself looking straight at Jane. The flashes going off around us lit up the road like a dance floor strobe, but she wasn't in any mood for dancing. Her eyes were flat and black. "He's coming for me," she said, as I pushed past several reporters who were almost dropping their notebooks in a rush to get closer to her. "He knows who I am, and he's coming for me." I put out a hand, whether to comfort or to push her away, I'm still not sure, but she interpreted it as a welcome and fell into my arms. The reporters went crazy, and I had to lead Jane away. If we'd stayed there, we wouldn't have just been on the front page. We'd give them enough to fill the whole paper. I commandeered a car from one of the forensics boys and just made it back to the station in front of the chasing pack. Jane didn't say a word, just sat and stared straight ahead, hot and heavy tears running down her cheeks. Reception was like a war zone. Four young constables were trying, unsuccessfully, to get two very drunk teenagers away from a baying pack of their friends. The arrival of the reporters didn't help matters, and several heads were cracked together and some blood spilled before sanity was finally restored. The reporters were dispatched out onto the pavement, along with the more sober teenagers. The rest were taken down to the cells. All in all, it was a good 20 minutes before I was able to get Jane into a quiet room, and by that time she was in deep shock. I sat her down in a chair and went to get some coffee. I had a feeling that the night was nowhere near over. Before I went back to her, I instructed Briggs to keep an ear open for anything that might indicate that our man had done another one, but as yet nothing had come in. Jane had her head in her hands as I entered the room, and when she looked up at me, her eyes were red-rimmed and moist. "It's coming for me," she said. I was shocked at the resignation in her voice. "It knows where I am, and it's coming for me." "You're safe here," I said, watching her shake her head sadly. "Not from this, I'm not," she said, and the crying started again. I wanted to hold her, to comfort her, but here in the station I was more used to the round of interrogation and recrimination. I stood quiet and watched her cry. I wasn't proud of it, but I needed whatever information she had. "Tell me," I said softly, but she only shook her head until I insisted. "Please tell me. We need to get this guy, and soon." Her voice was weak as she replied, "I don't know if anything I can tell you will do you any good, and I know you won't believe me anyway, but here goes." She took a long swig of coffee and a deep breath before starting. "First of all, it's old. I get a sense of great age and great evil. Every time I think about it, I think of water, deep, dark, cold water, and second, it's not human." She must have seen the thought in my eyes. "I knew you wouldn't believe me, but that doesn't make it any less real to me. There's one other thing, besides the water, that is. I get a picture, some sort of spiral pattern. It's important, but quite how, I'm not sure." Up to now, she had been holding herself together, but her resolve failed in the face of my disbelief. She began sobbing, great heaving gasps, and this time I couldn't ignore her. I took her in my arms and held her tight until the sobs subsided, and when she offered her mouth for a kiss, I couldn't refuse. We were interrupted by a discreet cough from the door. I looked over Jane's shoulder into the smiling face of Sergeant Briggs.
"Sorry to interrupt you, sir, but Donnelly, the victim's ex, has just come in. Do you want to talk to him?"
I held Jane at arm's length. "Are you going to be okay?" She nodded her head, and she didn't exactly smile, but there was a twinkle in her eye that I had never seen before as I left the room. My good feelings lasted just as long as it took me to get to my office and see the man in my visitor's chair. He was wrong. There was no other word for it. Maybe some of Jane's talent had worn off on me, or maybe it just came from years of sitting across the desk from criminals, but if this guy wasn't guilty of something, then I'd retire straight away. It was in his eyes,
a deep flicker of madness that he couldn't hide in spite of his slick hairstyle and sharp suit. Then there was a smile. He showed me all his teeth as I sat down.
"So what's going on, Inspector? I've already told your guys all I know."
"I doubt that," I said, and took delight as that smile slipped just a bit, but enough. I settled in my chair and lit a cigarette. I refrained from blowing smoke in his face. That would have been just too theatrical. "I need to know about you and Mary," I said, then leaned back and waited for him to speak. He was good, I'll give him that, but nobody has ever managed to psych me out when I'm sitting in my own chair. Besides, I had a feeling that this one liked to talk. I was proved right 10 seconds later.
"I met her on holiday last year. When we got back, I rang her up and we went out a few times, but she wasn't really my type. A bit too frigid, if you know what I mean."
I let out a long plume of smoke before I spoke. "Where did you go?"
"Eh?"
"I said, where did you go on holiday?"
"Scotland," he said. "The Highlands, to be precise."
"See any good locks?" I asked. I don't know where that came from, but a policeman's subconscious spends all its time filtering possibilities, so it's no real surprise when you get just the right question. The only surprise to me was the response I got. I had never seen anyone go white as a sheet before. The blood drained from his face, and his eyes went blank.
"Can I have a cigarette, please?" he asked,
and before I replied, he had leaned across and grabbed the packet on the table. I put my hand out to stop him. My fingers fell on top of his, and the pictures started to unravel in my head like a high-quality film show. We are on the shores of a loch. There is still over an hour to nightfall, but already there is a chill in the air, a portent of the winter yet to come. The trees rustle softly, and occasionally a leaf falls to swim in the ripples for a while, before softly sinking to join its decaying brothers. I look over at Mary. She is shivering. Goosebumps have risen across her chest, and her pubic hair looks jet black in the dim light. The knife feels cold in my hand as I raise it above my head and begin the chant. Far out over the loch, the water rises in a hump, something pushing just under the surface, surging forward as it comes for us. The metal of the knife sings as I bring it down. Mary screams and squirms, but the knife sinks deep into the ground by her left shoulder. I try to grab her, but she wriggles away, still screaming. The last I see of her is the pale white of her buttocks as she pushes her way through the rhododendrons. I just have time to turn back toward the lock when there is a surge of blackness and a great wall of water falls over me, taking me down and away into darkness. I felt the cigarette pack being taken away from my hand and looked up into a pair of jet-black eyes. No pupil, no white, just pools of blackness. When he spoke, his voice was harsh and throaty. "This one awakened me and showed me where to find the feed that has been denied me. Now I will feed again." He jerked, one sudden convulsion, and he tore with his hands at the front of his shirt, buttons popping in sequence as he bared his chest. The tattoo was a wondrous piece of art. The serpent glowed in blacks and reds and purples, its coils spiraling inwards from the great leonine head, the body twisted and bent in a labyrinth of scaled muscle which seemed to flow and bulge in time with his breathing. His chest rose in one great heave, and the serpent peeled, there is no other word for it, actually peeled from his chest, uncoiling in one smooth motion, a blackness rising and rising from his chair. The air got damp, then damper still, the salty tang of the sea stinging my nostrils. I pushed my hair back against the wall and half rose as the room went black around me. All black apart from a pair of blood-red eyes that blazed and flared with hate. I felt my shirt go damp against my chest as I strained to breathe. A grayness was beginning to gather in front of my eyes when suddenly the weight lifted and the room went quiet. I was left alone in the room, staring at Donnelly's Cheshire Cat grin. "The girl first, and then it's your turn," he said, just as the screaming started in the hallway beyond. I wanted to smash that grin backwards into his face, but the screams grew louder, and this time I recognized them. I was off the chair and out of the room before the first echo died away, almost knocking over Briggs in the hall. "Don't let Donnelly out of the room," I shouted as I ran past him. When I entered the incident room, I thought it was too late. The walls ran damp with water, thick, black, oily water that dripped from the roof to splash in ever-growing puddles.
Jane lay on the floor, still and unmoving as black spirals of muscle tightened around her. The fiery red eyes shone bright in the dim light, and the mouth of the serpent drooled as it made its way closer to its victim's throat. It was only then that I realized she was still alive, still fighting. Her eyes were open, and her face frozen in intense concentration. She seemed to be holding the beast at bay by force of will alone. I moved closer and tried to grab at the black coils, but my hands slid over its surface and came away wet and slippery. No matter how I tried, I was unable to take hold of anything. "Too late," a voice came from behind me. I turned to see Donnelly in the doorway. His shirt was open, and the tattoo on his chest glowed and flowed in a fiery red light. He held a pair of scissors, my office scissors, and something dark dripped from the blades. Behind him in the corridor lay Briggs, slumped in a growing pool of blood. "Like I said, first the bitch, then you," Donnelly whispered, closing the door behind him and moving into the room. "There's nowhere for you to go, Donnelly," I said. "Why don't you give yourself up?" He laughed, and I heard the madness in his voice. "Nowhere to go? But I am the serpent. I go where I please and take what I want, and for now, I want you." He came forward, the scissors held in a knife fighter's grip. He was 6 inches taller than me, 20 years younger, and a good 2 stone lighter. What he didn't have were the years on the street, or the steel-tipped shoes. My left foot took him in the balls, and as he curled over, my right knee met his face, smashing his nose almost flat. I grinned as I felt the bone break. He fell sideways, dropping the scissors as I kicked him in the head again, one to keep him down and a second for good measure. I made sure he stayed down and turned back to Jane, half hoping to see her free from the grip, but she was still held tightly and the serpent still struggled to reach her face. I stabbed down hard and the scissors went in amongst the coil, but it was like cutting through water. I pulled my hand backwards, feeling the body of the serpent flow around my wrist. The scissors came out, and I caught a burst of red to my right. I turned just in time to see the glow fade on the tattoo of Donnelly's chest. Stabbing again, still watching Donnelly, I saw the tattoo flare redly in a spot approximately the place where I'd stabbed. I didn't need a second chance. I scrambled across the floor, noticing that there was now nearly an inch of water. Without a second thought, I brought the scissors down hard amid the coils of the tattoo and began to cut, stabbing and chopping my way through Donnelly's flesh. The room got suddenly colder, colder and wetter, and Jane screamed again. But I couldn't pause, couldn't stop as my right hand went up and came down, went up and came down. It didn't take long before Donnelly's chest was a mass of red, pulpy gore. I fell back in the water, gasping, letting the scissors fall away and taking in deep, sobbing breaths. I heard a quiet gasp behind me and turned just in time to see Jane push herself to her feet and slough off sheets of water from her body. There was no sign of the serpent. Afterwards, there was a hell of a row, of course. There was a lot to explain away, like several hundred gallons of salt water and a suspect with his face beaten to a pulp and his chest carved into strips of ham. Briggs and I managed to concoct a story between us. We both took early retirement soon after. I got a gold watch, a pension, and a wife. Only the last helps me sleep without screaming.
Friend of a friend. There's a phrase guaranteed to set some people's teeth on edge, but it's the basis of urban myths, and they, my friends, are everywhere. We live in a society built on the foundations of history and myth and supposition, and the funny thing about those foundations is that they keep finding their way to the surface, most frequently in the form of urban myths. Whether it's the gang car, an initiation rite whereby a gang member drives around with their lights off at night and must kill the occupants of the first car to flash them, or the kindly terrorist myth that circulated so widely, even I got two different versions of it post-September 11th, society is at least as concerned with what could be as it is with what is. Even the gossip mags follow this model. After all, what else is the latest endless set of celebrity pseudo-news than a framework of aspirational myth for us to hang our lives off? Oh, it's also kind of dull as well. The trick, of course, is not to get too reliant on it, not to let myth and supposition crystallize into a worldview. Because the moment you do that, the very moment you know for a fact something that cannot possibly be true, well, things tend to get a little confusing. Case in point, a friend of my father's used to live in Todmorden, which, to borrow an old John Hurt line, looks a lot like the bit of Yorkshire God made right after he got really angry. It's all sheer valleys, windswept heaths, and the distant ghostly tones of Kate Bush as she wanders the moors looking for Heathcliff or a film crew, whichever turns up first. Also, entertainingly, it's a massive UFO hotspot. Anyway, Uncle Pete was in the pub one day when he looked up and saw the past looking back at him. 8 feet away, outside the pub, partially obscured by a parked car, there was a man on horseback, in full round head armour, with a weapon, looking very, very confused. In the time it took Pete to look, turn away, register what he'd just seen, and look back, the man had vanished and no one else had seen him. For a while, Pete was very troubled. After all, had he just seen a ghost? Had he just seen a section of time, momentarily dislodged from its rightful place, dropped into the car park of a pub? Had he seen an echo of the past? As it turns out, he'd seen a reenactor who'd got a bit lost. Face value, whether it's face value normality or face value weird, is never something to be taken lightly. So, look a little deeper, because next time, you might see something surprising. Or at the very least, you might be able to point a man on a horse in the right direction. We rely on you to pay our authors, so if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you won't regret it. Pseudopod is a production, or podcution, as I appear to have typed here, of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod would like you to start at the beginning. Assume we know nothing.